Thank you, Jimmy, and it's a pleasure to be here with you today and talk a little bit about conservation. I'll share with you a few of the broad overviews of some of the programs that are out there at USGA and other aspects, and then try to close out with those things and those tips and techniques that you can perhaps use to improve your odds, if you will, when you're applying for those programs, because those programs are very competitive in nature. And as we go through those, I'll give you a few hints on how we go through that, but then at the end, come back to those things as you move forward. Now, the great thing about the conservation programs that are offered by USDA, and that I had such great pleasure in helping deliver when I was Chief of Natural Resources Conservation Service, is in fact that these are all voluntary programs, served and designed to assist an individual producer to do the conservation they want to do on their farm or ranch. These are not mandatory programs. They're not regulatory in nature as much as they are a means to provide the outreach and the assistance. And that's the vitally important part of conservation. Now, the program that you'll see the most attention to and you'll see the greatest discussion on is the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. EQIP has been around for almost a decade now as a program. It is voluntary. It provides cost share up to 75%, but not necessarily that high in all cases. And it supports both structural and management practices. So you think about the traditional conservation structural practices that are out there, terracing, those sorts of things. That's what EQIP does. But it also can provide assistance in locations on management practices. And these are more cutting edge. Water management, feed management, nutrient management, to be able to do those things. And in some parts of the country, even provide assistance to people in the transition from conventional tillage to no tillage. But that's not in all cases and in all areas of the country. Now, funding for the program, it's over $1 billion a year nationwide. Now, I always just say plus plus on this because on an annual basis, Congress tends to take a little bit of the money away in the appropriations process. But overall, at $1 billion a year, this buys a great deal of conservation. And the states in which cotton is grown also tend to be the states that get some of the larger, if not the largest, total allocations for conservation. And certainly Texas, California lead that particular list. Now, a key thing on this program, and you're going to hear me mention this on the others as well, when you apply to participate in EQIP, and I know as I look around the room, many of you already have and are players in this, but as you apply on this, the applications are ranked and scored by the environmental services that you're going to provide, which means that the government is looking for how much environmental services, how many goods and services, water quality protection, soil protection can they purchase per dollar that's invested in that application. That's very key to understanding because of the fact that if you think of the way other federal programs are, if you apply for something, if you're eligible, you get the dollars, and if it's backlogged, well, you just sit in the back of the line until you move to the front of the line. In the case of EQIP and other conservation programs, it's always based off of the environmental goods and services that are provided. So it may not make a difference whether your application has been in the queue for 1 year or 3 years or 5 years. And so it's very important to follow that. The other thing about EQIP, even though it's $1 billion a year, there's always a backlog on those programs. Now here's the great thing about this particular program. Applications from an individual producer are accepted on a continuous basis. So you go in and make your application on your time. Now I recommend that you do this with as much lead time as you possibly can because applications will be once a year closed and ranked, and that application decision on the closure and the ranking will be done on a state basis. There's not a national sign-up period, but rather a state-by-state period. And that is intended in order to make sure that the conservation works best in your state, given the growing seasons, given the management decisions that occur in your particular area. Now, with EQIP, there are 5 national priorities. And it's important to understand these priorities because as you're wanting to do something on conservation on your farm operation, you want to look as to how that fits in those national priorities and then ultimately in state priorities. Now, it's pretty easy to get almost anything you want to do on your farm operation into one of these 5 priorities, but they are reduction of non-point source pollution on impaired watersheds. And there's a special project that's going on right now within USDA targeted towards the Mississippi Basin. And so upper and lower Mississippi Basin efforts targeting on watershed, on water quality and water quantity are going to rank very high. Second one, conservation of ground and surface water resources. There's probably no industry that has been as great a leader on water conservation as it pertains to irrigation as has been the cotton sector. And as such, you've got an inherent advantage in looking at how do you move forward on things that do further improvements. Transitions from flood irrigation to pivot or from flood all the way to drip irrigation tend to rank out very high in most states' ranking priorities because of those particular things. The third one, reduction of air emissions. And this is not about carbon sequestration and those sorts of things, but rather about non-attainment areas as it pertains to air quality. If any of you are from California, you know very well the kinds of challenges that have faced the cotton industry in California over the last 10 years, and that's where these priorities are coming in from. Now, Natural Resources Conservation Service. You know, it used to be called the Soil Conservation Service, and they can never go too far from those soil conservation roots, and that's why reduction in soil erosion continues to be a major priority, and it continues to be closely linked both with air and water quality issues as you move forward. The fifth and final point, and it's important to look at how this dissects, is promotion of at-risk species habitat conservation. This doesn't mean NRCS is now in the business of endangered species work, but rather trying to assist producers in providing habitat for species that may be in a decline and moving forward on that. And a good example of that right here in Louisiana is habitat for the Louisiana black bear. But an example that many of you will acquaint with is actually work on improving habitat for the bobwhite quail. NRCS and conservation, while this is a federal program coming from USDA, is intentionally designed to have as much local input and state priority setting as possible. Decisions should not be made in Washington, D.C. on what the best conservation practices are in Georgia or Alabama or Texas. Those need to be made at the state and local level in those respective states because the strategies and the priorities are going to vary from one state to another. And so with all of the programs that are offered by USDA, there are state priorities that are established. Those are established by what is known as the state conservationist. This is a career federal employee that is the head of the Natural Resources Conservation Service. That decision is made in consultation with something called the State Technical Committee. Now, the State Technical Committee looks a little different from state to state. And so you go to a state like California and you may have 200 people who are all comers from environmental groups to ag groups all sitting there serving on that State Technical Committee. In another state, whether you're in Mississippi or Texas, you're talking about a much smaller group with a much more active participation from individual farmers. But that State Technical Committee is the group that is charged with determining greatest priority on the programs, leaning it towards water quantity or water quality, traditional efforts on soil erosion, or endangered species. The other thing that is very key here is that the programs look a little different from state to state. Now, for the few of you that may operate in multiple states, this can be a bit of a frustration at times. But for most of us, this is extraordinarily important because it's so key that conservation should in fact work and act differently in the Cotton Belt than it does in the Corn Belt. And that's a key part of this, and that's where these programs look so very different than other federal programs as you move forward. Now, that's a little bit on EQIP. The new program, and the one that I know Robbie talked about at length this morning as well, is the new Conservation Stewardship Program. And this is one that really provides a great deal of opportunity for many folks throughout Cotton Country, and one that is still in a state of evolution. And so as we get into the Q's and A's, I'm going to be very interested in what some of your experiences have been about this. There were two programs that go by the initials of CSP. First, the Conservation Security Program. This was in the last Farm Bill in 2002. And now the Conservation Stewardship Program that is in the latest Farm Bill and the one that's being implemented right now. Now, this program has been improved dramatically in moving from the Conservation Stewardship Program to the Conservation Security Program. It's more streamlined, it's more producer-friendly, fewer burdens, fewer hurdles in the application process. But the key thing here, again, a voluntary program, you only participate if you want to participate as a producer, and it is offered on a nationwide basis. Now, this program is targeted to assist an individual landowner with adopting conservation enhancements. And it's really targeted to those leading-edge conservations. With EQIP, I often call the old EQIP program a fix-it program. You've got a particular challenge on your farm operation that you want to address. You can use EQIP like a rifle shot to address that particular challenge. But if you've been in conservation for many years and you've participated in EQIP and you've got a conservation plan and you're trying to go to a higher level, there's never been a program that's really worked well for you. CSP is intended to do that. It's also intended to incentivize and recognizing existing whole farm conservation. And that is the real opportunity that lies with CSP, in that this is not an idle land conservation program, but a working lands conservation program. And it's intended to provide a per-acre benefit or per-acre payment to you for the management associated with conservation. Not the structures, not building fences or building structures, but the management associated with conservation, be that nutrient management, no-till management, residue management, grazing management that may be out there, depending on what the resource concerns are on your farm operation. Overall, CSP is going to be targeted at 12.7 million acres per year. That means it's going to be a very, very large program. By the end of this Farm Bill cycle, it will be larger than the Conservation Reserve Program at 32 million acres. It will be larger than EQIP, which is well over 40 million acres today. First sign-up just ended this past year at the end of September. And so we're just now in the stage of starting to get an idea of how well the program has worked in Cotton Country and which ways we may be able to improve upon it. And the Cotton Council has been very, very active in that process. Over the next few weeks, we expect to be able to start seeing which applications were ultimately accepted in the final pools, which ones ranked out, and how many acres were ultimately accepted into the program. The priorities for CSP, and they can vary from one to one, are going to be very much like the ones that I outlined for EQIP: water, soil, air, and habitat. The state priorities and the local priorities will be established state by state. And as you're considering an application, even if you're working with your county NRCS people, you want to go on to the state website and really look at what are the priorities that are listed in that state. Because the priorities in Texas and Louisiana are different than the ones in Mississippi and Alabama as you move forward. And again, those priorities are determined basically in consultation with the state technical committee. Sign up on this program. Again, it's continuous. Sign up for the last program, started August 10th and then closed September 30th. I do not expect that sort of a tight ranking in this year. Technically, you should be able to go into your NRCS office, to your local service center, and apply for CSP today for this year. NRCS is currently in the process of ranking all those applications that closed last fall. And so that's going to be the first priority over accepting applications, but you should be able to submit an application right now for the Conservation Security Program should you be interested in that. Now, remember I mentioned with EQIP, they're making an evaluation based off of the environmental goods and services that the government is going to buy from your farm operation. In the case of CSP, the USDA has created a bit of a black box called a conservation measurement tool. That measurement tool will be used to rank your application and compare Jay Hardwick's application to Jimmy Webb's application if they were in the same state to look at which one's going to provide greatest services. You can go on the website and you can see the ranking formulas. And they're long and they're complicated, but they give you an idea of how things are supposed to be done. USDA is trying to make those so that they're size neutral. They shouldn't be making a ranking application difference between a large commercial operation and a small operation as you're moving forward on those in the workings of the CMT. There will be two potential payments associated with the CSP payment. An annual payment, this is for both your existing conservation work and any additional performance that you may apply for and commit to. Now, for any of you that are going to be anywhere close to a payment limitation on this program, you want to look very closely to what you may be committing to for additional things. Because you don't want to be committing to more conservation than you're getting paid for in the particular program. And that is a very unique challenge here, and it's one that in some counties that NRCS person is going to work real closely with you on it, and in other counties that person is going to be trying to get you to commit to as much conservation as you possibly can. Now, the payment limit on this on an annual basis is $40,000 a year. And for a larger operation, it's going to be very easy to commit to more conservation than the compensation will be associated with. And that's one that's going to be a very personal decision on your part on how you move forward on it. Now, that's the annual payment. The second payment is a supplemental payment that came about. It's being highlighted, and that's for resource conserving crop rotation. Now, there is a bit of a conundrum for cotton as it pertains to this because of the management strategies that are needed in order to control boll weevil and other pests. That means that there has to be something in the rotation, corn, perhaps a perennial forage, somewhere in the rotation to balance the lesser conservation that may be associated with taking that residue away. And so, but that too is a payment structure that may be out there on those things. Now, I mention this only because with the program in its first year, we're going to be learning a lot of lessons over the next month or two on how things went about. And Cotton Council submitted comments on your behalf on how to improve your program, how to manage it on payment limits, how to move forward on those things, how to address that balance between how much conservation is committed to and purchased versus the payment limits, as well as strong comments on how to make sure that the program works to the benefits of folks that are in cotton country. I expect changes in this program over this next year based off of the lessons learned in this first year of sign-up. And so while you can submit an application now, and I would encourage you to be in talking to NRCS about that application, until they do a final ranking for 2010, you might want to go slow on the final submission of your application, because you want to really get as much information as you possibly can about lessons learned from 2009 before you do a final submission. And remember, timing of that application doesn't give you an advantage as much as working with your district conservationist and in having the highest environmental ranking in your given community. Now, let me bounce across through a couple of other programs. I'm going to do these in a real light manner, because the real opportunity here comes when the producers who have the experience in cotton country come up, talk to you a little bit about things, and then we'll get into a little Q&A. There is a small program that I always like to mention because of the opportunities that it presents for many folks, and that's the Wildlife Habitat Incentives Program. This is like a mini EQIP program for specific wildlife benefits. And if you're on your farm operation trying to manage for wildlife, or if you're taking in hunters and needing to improve things for bobwhite quail or anything like that, this is a great program for providing the technical assistance. The other good thing about this program, while it's only probably $30 or $40 million a year nationwide, it is not oversubscribed like EQIP is. And so when you're trying to manage some of these programs and you have intense competition in EQIP, if you have a strategy that will fit in WIP, you may get your contract approved earlier, more quickly, and easily in WIP than you will in EQIP as you move forward. And it, like all the others, has continuous enrollment. Now, there's a basket of easement programs, and I mentioned these. Some parts of the country, folks aren't wanting to use the easement programs at all. Other parts of the country, these have a great deal of potential. And so I always want to mention these programs. USDA offers 4 easement programs now, where they are purchasing a particular good or service, a right from your farm operation, to be able to conserve a particular thing. The first one, the Farm and Ranch Lands Protection Program. This is used primarily on the rural-urban interface to protect from farmland from development. But it is offered in every single state in the Union. So it's not just something that you do in Northern Virginia, and it's not just something that you do in other parts of the country, but it's something that works on the outskirts of Memphis, on the outskirts of even Jackson, Mississippi, and certainly in Texas. And so there is an opportunity here for some producers as they move forward on this. The other one, Wetland Reserve Program. Massive participation in Mississippi and Arkansas on the flyways on this. That makes it very popular with some cotton producers, very unpopular with others based off of the competition for those lands. New program that came about in the 2002 program that you may think of primarily as for the Plains states, but is in every state, is a Grasslands Reserve Program. And so while it may be of greatest popularity and the greatest backlog in the state where I come from, in South Dakota or in Texas, it also has utility and opportunity in Alabama and Georgia if you've got a grassland that you want to put in to a permanent Grasslands Reserve Program. Also, the new program, Healthy Forest Reserve Program. And this works in the same way to protect those woodlots that many of us have on our operations to be able to move forward on these things. On these whole easement programs, all 5 of these, you really want to move cautiously, carefully on these, and think hard about what you're doing. Most of them are long-term or permanent easements. This is a legacy issue for many farm operations, and you are encumbering that land for future generations. Key thing to look at on some of these programs: who will hold that easement, and is that a good partner for you to work with or your heirs to work with in the future? Some areas, Farm and Ranch Land Protection Program, you're working with a land trust. In the case of the WRP, you're working with USDA, and those are federally held. That determines who's visiting that land, when they visit it, how they provide oversight on it, and those things. Now, a lot of people tend to try to get into these easement programs because they may need to do some debt retirement, and this works really well for debt retirement. But for people that are facing really tough financial straits, rarely will an easement come through quickly enough to forestall bankruptcy or something like that, because it takes a long time, often years, to perfect an easement, to enroll, and get funding on those particular programs. The next program I'll talk a little bit about is the Conservation Reserve Program, which is not offered by NRCS, but rather by the Farm Service Agency, but is a vital part of the conservation portfolio. This is a land idling program, a remediation program, a way in which to be able to manage some of those acres that we all have in our community that perhaps never should have been brought into farming and into agriculture. This has been around a long time. It was started in the 1985 Farm Bill, and the interesting thing is that with this 2008 Farm Bill, a determination was made that the acres will actually decrease. That means that as you're planning your farm operation, thinking about how to move forward, the chances of a general sign-up, given where things are in agriculture today, are really pretty slim. If there is any sort of a general sign-up, it's probably going to be geared towards re-enrollments for those people that are in the Conservation Reserve Program today. However, in the 20 years that the CRP has been in existence, it has evolved from those whole farm sign-ups and whole fields farm sign-ups into a much more surgical program that will be offered on a continuous basis that may complement some of the other conservation work you're trying to do on your farm operation. The continuous sign-up aspect of CRP will continue, will be very vibrant, and in many cases the per acre payments can be considerable. They are targeted towards environmentally desirable acres, tends to be either wetlands or filter strips, and in the case, especially here in Louisiana, move up the river into Arkansas, bottomland hardwoods. And if you're in the right states, some states have very generous programs called Conservation Reserve Enhancement Programs, where the state is partnering after a particular thing to be able to do. And so you see that with Bob White initiatives and some of those things. The expiration of the existing CRP acres is a key thing for you all to be watching. The statute limits this to 30 to 2 million acres. In June of last year, we had 33.7 million acres enrolled. 3.5 million acres actually expired last year, so we're down below that cap a little ways today, but that's going to be a very key thing to watch. This is a mature program, but the key thing here is there are opportunities for you to use CRP as part of that larger whole farm strategy. So that gets you to how do you improve the odds. Those are the big programs: EQIP, CSP, CRP, the basket of easement programs, the WIP, the Wildlife Habitat Incentives Program. Conservation, I'll be the first to admit, sometimes tends to be a little clubbish and a little cliquish. If you're participating in the conservation movement, you can get in. If you're a newcomer to it, it can be hard to break into that conservation effort. These are intended to help you on being able to break into that if you're in one of those scenarios. First thing, know what the priorities are. The national priorities: water, soil, air, habitat. Know the state priorities, those things that have been determined with the state consultation with the state technical committee. If I can encourage Cotton to do anything, is to make sure, state by state, that you are investing the right leaders into attendance at those state technical committees. It's hard work. At times it's frustrating, but it's exceedingly important in being able to help on those priorities. NRCS has a key partner in delivering its conservation. As a federal agency, it can't do it all alone. So a lot of that work is done in conjunction with the conservation districts. Conservation districts are very vibrant in some parts of the country, less vibrant in others, but it's a key partnership in delivering those things. And so a key part in making sure that your application comes out high in the ranking process is for you to be a participant and work with your local conservation district on those things. That local and state-based prioritization is very important, it's very appropriate, and it's what makes NRCS and the conservation programs different than any other federal agency. It's not like federal program benefits, it's not like Social Security, it's not like any of those things from that aspect, where everything is offered the same and uniform on the national level. These have state priorities, state-based programs, different practices based on what's there in a particular state. If your state isn't providing the service you may need, you may want to look at what a neighboring state is doing as far as a priority and encourage them to bring that particular priority into those things. Now, you're going to place an application. You want to look hard at which program you apply for. EQIP's the largest, so it tends to be where most of the applications go. That's where the money is, and that's very appropriate. But it's also the greatest backlogs. So at times, you may be able to do some of the same things in the new CSP program. Pays for the enhancement activities, pays for management activities. You can do those in either EQIP or in CSP. As I mentioned before, wildlife. You can use WIP or EQIP, and WIP doesn't have as large a backlog depending on which state you're in. The other thing you can do is you can partner with state agencies. State wildlife agencies often have a few dollars to help leverage. And they base those things off of the same conservation plans that may be out there. So you can use tap into the state conservation funds or state wildlife funds, and quite often you can stack them or leverage them on the USDA funds. The other thing are foundations. You want to look very closely for what the foundation community may be providing. Now, as a rule, that search tends to work best if you're in a particular priority area. And so that may be Lower Mississippi Valley, bottomland hardwood restoration, tends to have a lot of funds associated with that. In Georgia, funding associated for building ponds and reservoirs to address groundwater recharge areas in the Flint River. That's where you need to know the local priorities in your area and try to match what you want to do on your farm operation with what the priorities that may be there in the state aspect of things. The last key thing that I mentioned on how to improve your odds is to go into the NRCS office and ask them to prepare a conservation plan for your particular farm operation. You don't have to have that conservation plan first for any of the programs I mentioned. But by doing that conservation plan first and investing the time in that, you're then in a position to be able to determine which of these programs work best for your farm operation. And because you've started working with that district conservationist on building that plan, they're also knowing which of those programs will work best in your farm operation, as there are monies available, as there are programs available that are out there. This last one, it's instinctive for many of us, but it's really key, and I've talked to several of you about this, and that is relationships matter. If you go into the USDA office and you're gruff and belligerent with those folks, you're creating challenges for yourself on being able to go in. If you build that relationship with the district conservationist, build that relationship with the FSA County Executive Director, with those folks on the conservation districts, it makes a tremendous difference. difference on how you work on these things. And the stakes are great. You know, we were talking about that earlier, you know, because of the amount of money that all of us in agriculture have riding with FSA, we treat each other respectfully when we go into the FSA office because we know darn well I got a good chunk of change riding on that relationship. You've got the same sort of thing in conservation now with the number of programs that are out there. And so, again, those relationships matter. Finally, for your area, know the hot buttons. The hot buttons on conservation. In California, it's air quality and water quantity. Lower Mississippi Valley, it's habitat, water quality. Chesapeake Bay, it's water quality, stream flow. The thing is, all conservation is local. And you need to know what those priorities are at the local level and match those with what you're trying to do on your farm operation. With that, I appreciate very much the chance to give you all the broad overview of conservation. A little bit about the programs. I know I've been redundant with some of you on those things, but hoping to also provide you the tips on how to improve your odds as you make an application for any one of these conservation programs. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce. Jay, you want to come tell about your equip and whatever you've done, then I'll tell them about mine.
I don't have prepared remarks, but I do have a process I'd like to describe briefly to you. Our family and myself have been committed to conservation on our farm, probably very much like you, because that's why you're in this room for years, maybe even generations. And there have been plenty of programs that we may have access to the old SES, or may in fact done ourselves on our own farm at our own expense, whether it's grade stabilizations or culverts to take care of eroding gullies or grass waterways that we didn't have technical assistance on. A number of features that we just thought were good things to do in order to preserve the quality of the land and the capability to produce those crops. So we've had a rich commitment to that, but also we've participated in many of the programs that Bruce has outlined here that have been beneficial. And I have to comment briefly that it took me a while to figure this out, and maybe most of you already understand that in this room, is that NRCS and the technical facilities and the programs that are there are not meant to be or confused with farm income support. Now that might seem obvious, but I think a lot of people don't understand that. And knowing the difference sets into motion a number of things. First of all, it's quite easy with FSA to compute your payment based upon your acres and so forth and your payment rate on your yield. And the computations can be made simply in a matter of pushing a button, so to speak, and a payment is made. Trying to employ that onto the NRCS side is difficult, if not impossible, in the same way because other things happen. Technical facility, understanding the formation of conservation plans. A lot goes into that thinking that is a lot more deliberate, and as a result is not really meant to be income support, but what are the resource problems that you have on your property that you've identified, and how can I best manage those and get support in that cost sharing? So you have to have that understanding going into it. It's not meant to be. Now that's not to say that over time we might have conservation do something entirely different, and we're seeing some of that stage being set with legislation. Nonetheless, we have taken advantage of certain programs that outlined here this morning or this afternoon. The continuous CRP program has been very popular in our area and in our farm operation, where we're taking land that was not really supposed to be cleared back in the 70s when the bean invasion hit our part of the world. More sensitive areas, we took those out willfully at one point, and then we had a program that came in with a rental rate and made that even more appetizing. So we've taken other lands out, as well as we have a threatened species, the black bear, who has made a resurgence in our area. In my hypothesis, if you would permit me to do that, is based upon the fact that we've changed from a extensive tillage operation to a sort of no-till, high residue crop management in terms of other crops. We're no longer just monocrop cotton as we were at one time. have a whole host of other crops, corn, soybean, grain, sorghum, we've had peanuts, we've had sunflowers, and so forth. That has enabled a lot of foraging opportunities for wildlife that have been indicated for us as rebounding because the population numbers have increased so dramatically. But also the capability of the land has changed, and we have come to understand that, the role of residue and best management practices. And what I'm trying to do is paint a picture here that there wasn't a formula that went into place to thinking about this, but things just emerged and became available, and our thinking changed in terms of how we looked at the land and how we best wanted to manage that. So the programs that were coming about seemed to be very significant. However, what was lacking was a program that actually rewarded ownership or operations, a combination, for the management practices that were being employed. They were not meant to set up the programs that if you change your bad behavior, we will reward it. Let's reward good behavior. Now, isn't that different? And so the CSP program, the original Conservation Security Program, I think started out with that kind of emphasis, and now it's morphed into the Conservation Stewardship Program, which I think is uniquely poised to be very useful in many ways of addressing resource problems, but also rewarding each one of you in this room and developing plans that will encourage you to adopt other habits that are improving the wildlife or the major priorities, water, soil, air, and the habitat, which I think we can all agree are important things. The problem that I see with some of the programs is, for example, in my application for the Conservation Stewardship Program this year, which was looked at, and we have a high rate of participation in our Soil Conservation District. I think there were 30-some applications that were put in, even under the old program that failed for us, because most of us withdrew from that program. But this program seemed to have some of the details worked out into it, where the scoring ability all looked very good, solid. The program development and the conservation plan, working with the Soil Conservation District, as well as the conservationists and state conservation, all those things were going very smoothly. Many operations in our part of the world in northeast Louisiana along the Mississippi River are old land tracts that go back post-Civil War. So those tracts have, by and large, stayed in place. So we have conservation spread over large acres. And the way I was able to financially take care of that is I spread the risk or the cost of them over many acres. Some of those practices were very expensive to employ. So a small farm, not to be disparaging to a small farm, it would be hard-pressed at times to think about implementing some cost share programs or even something on your own to do that. So a large farm seemed to be once and for all a reward for that effort, not to be egotistical or any form or another, but it truly was a relief to see that happening. However, this is what I want to bring up with two points, and Bruce has alluded to them, and I think will be fixed in maybe the next round. The thing of eligibility. I can tell you that my initial score put me as second highest in our area, and with a score that combined far exceeded the $40,000 payment limit as a whole farm. Matter of fact, the $40,000 would only cover about 800 acres of 8,000 acres that I work of a family farm. So that's a discouraging element right there, is that there is a level by saying, okay, well, if only 1,000 acres work, well, that's all of enroll. No, you got to enroll the whole farm. So immediately you see the return on the investment by the Federal Treasury is pretty competitive. They would rather pay me for a smaller amount than the larger amount. But the land, by their own calculations, their own analysis, generated the return and the payment. But I am not eligible. I'm further not eligible because of an effort to use identifying who has control of the land. And that might seem simple, though. Show me a lease. Show me something. NRCS was under severe pressure with the old CSP program to try to establish who had control of the land. And so what NRCS has done in this go-around is adopt the FSA designation of who has control by who is the operator. Well, in that process, the operator may in fact not be the largest renter or the tenant of that piece of property. So on two family farms that we have, I am not eligible and I have the most practices on that piece of property. Isn't that stupid? I didn't use that word when I was talking to them, of course. But here is a way to bring in a large set of acres, and I'm not the only one, in our community, that presents a high rate of return in an effort that is in a large segment. Now, the challenge is that if they're willing to pay $40,000 for 800 acres, or was it, say, 1,000 acres, on 1,000 farms, 40, why can't we do it for one farm of 8,000 acres? There's something about writing a $320,000 check that's just not going to go down. Even though the land, by their own computation and analysis, generated that score. So whether that'll be fixed or not, I don't know. So as a result, I'm not offering my R farm for that contract because I think it's too little to tie up too much land at this point. Hopefully the other part of the operator designation will be changed so that other farm numbers within our family farm can be included in on it. But those are the biggest, the two elements that I see that once again penalize large farms, although its intent was not to do that. So I hope that part comes around, is played out. My intent is not to game the system, but if the land is truly scored by their own process, X amount of dollars, and if those funds are available, maybe it's a rationing problem, then let it be what it is. That's my comment.
Thank you, Jeff. That kind of summed it up there pretty quick. If your land qualifies, but yet, some of the practices are not worth it. That's the way we look at it too. What I was going to talk about is my experiences from the past, not this new program, but what I have used and what a lot of us use in Georgia. And before there was even a program that I was even aware of, we built two ponds on our farm for irrigation. I'm a irrigated producer, 100% irrigated. Where I am, I feel like if I can't irrigate, I won't make a crop. A dryland producer has a real tough time where I am in the southwest corner of Georgia. Our water leaches out pretty quick. We can get 2-inch rain in July, and in 2 days I need to irrigate. That's our soil. But we built two ponds in order to irrigate with. And now, I don't know when that program started, but now they'll help me build a pond. Well, I jumped the gun on that, and I did just like what Jay alluded to. We did that to improve the farm we had and try to make the farm better for generations to carry on. The first program we used was with Equip, and that's the one I'm most familiar with because that's the one that works the best for me. Has the most money, but it works. First thing we did was grass waterways where we had bad erosion in certain fields, just in certain spots. And we fixed those waterways with help from Equip, from the government, and it has made a great improvement in those fields. Stopped erosion. Where the irrigation systems would walk, sometimes the ruts would get 2 and 3 feet deep. The water just kept running down. Well, we put the waterways in, that eliminated that problem. The other thing we did was, it was called an enhancement of our center pivot irrigation systems. When our first pivots were put in, they were high pressure systems, which means it took a lot of horsepower to pump the water. You had sprinklers on top of the pipe, and you took a lot of pressure to pump the water. Well, we converted all of them through a grant with Equip, converted them to a low pressure system, so therefore your horsepower needs were dropped, so it cost less money to pump. We had drops that took the water from the top of the pipe down to what's called the truss rod, which is probably about 10 feet off the ground. Well, with doing that, we cut the horsepower needs, so that cut our cost. In the hot summer days, with the water on top of the pipe shooting up in the air, we would probably lose 2 to sometimes 3/10 of an inch of rain or water that we were putting out. We eliminated that. We felt like we got all of that back. We might lose a tenth, but we got a major majority of it back. And the other program that a lot of us use is in Georgia, we have to strip till. We're gonna create a hard pan, so we have to do some kind of deep tillage. Well, there's a lot of strip tillage that went on, which meant we would plant a cover crop, and then you would burn the cover crop down in the spring right before you plant it. And they would pay us, you know, you'd sign a 3-year contract to do that. And this was great what they did here. I'm a peanut grower. I grow cotton too, but peanuts are my number one crop. We plant peanuts in those fields every third year. So every 3 years, we have to take a moldboard plow, bottom plow, and turn the land. Well, when we first applied, they weren't going to let us do it. They were going to kick us out. But in our area, you know, peanuts are such a small crop, specialty crop. They allowed us to be in the program 2 years, just take 1 year off, and then the third year we'd get back in, which I thought that was great for them being flexible to work with. That's been a big program for us, but with the problems that we're having now with the resistance to Palma amaranth, that program's getting a new look because you're having people are going back to tillage. You know, they don't have a choice. But that's my experience where I've used it, and we didn't use it. You know, like Jay said, we didn't use it to supplement the income on the farm. What we used it was try to take what we had and make it better and make our farm better, and it's all worked. That's my comment. We're going to open it up for questions. Anybody got questions? Jimmy?
Bruce, you may want to come back.
I made an application for a food program. I haven't decided whether we'll do that application process yet. And I haven't been able to get a clear designation of what I'm expected to do under the terms of the contract application. In other words, we fill out a survey talking about the practices and the conservation and the services.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a chance to fill out another thing that's going to be interesting. Then I get a letter saying that you scored your farm, your particular farm is scored for $70 of the size of the farm. Then it's only the same thing, but I've had to ask the special question.
Right.
Situation and basically, this is for a partnership. A general partnership with four members, a farm with about 34 acres, a partnership qualifies for about $364,000 in the size of the farm.
Mm-hmm.
I could have only 5 or 40% of those farms. And then I'll put a 4-page spread on those farms. When I filled out the application, I wasn't aware that I was paying interest in the credit anyway. And so I applied for all the funds. And now I'm saying I want to reduce my application to just the funds to maximize the paying interest and not just paying all the funds outside of it.
Right. You're
saying if I pull one bond out of the application, the application is going to. So those are three similar issues
that specific issues
across the state for 2010.
Can I throw something in there?
Okay, let's make it a little more complicated.
So I operate as a general partnership myself. Why?
I operate as a general partnership myself. Why does it, in the FSA office, each individual partner has an individual payment limit? But when you do this, the partnership has one payment limit. That doesn't make any sense.
Okay, let me try to tackle a couple of these things with you all on this. First, on the payment limit stuff. NRCS is currently interpreting the statute more restrictively than I would personally on the statute. And they're interpreting it more strictly than FSA does. And that's why an operation with multiple owners is being held to one $40,000 limit on an annual basis as opposed to each of the operations like FSA would have, be a participant on that. I know from working with Robbie and Craig that Cotton Council has been very active in suggesting to NRCS that this isn't a very good and crisp, clear interpretation, and I would agree with that, but this is one that's going to take time to fix on the policy size, and it's one that the current attitude in D.C. is not very sympathetic to resolving. Now, second thing has to do with control. On the control of the property, when I was chief of the agency, I was very specific with folks about we need to have some common sense that if you have had this in control for years and years, that sort of history should be able to come into play. And we've tried to argue with NRCS that the penalties for withdrawal and having to refund the dollars are adequate to protect this. However, what occurred is that in the oversight of the original CSP program, some people abused the flexibility that had been put in place there. And the auditors actually found tenants that had enrolled land without telling the landlord, and they found landlords that had enrolled property without working with the tenants. And because of that, we're now facing a much more restrictive scenario. Now, in your particular instance where you're capping out on the payment limit, and they say that all the land has to be enrolled in the in your upcoming application, but you have some land that you'd like to have in, but you don't have a lease that's long-term. Will they take that land out now?
No.
Because even though the fact, yeah, but you don't have control of that. So if you don't have control of that, their own rules say that they should be taking that out of the operation. And see, in some areas, in some counties, that land that you don't have control, if that falls out, it didn't put you in a better scenario on the payment limits. And some counties are allowing folks to do that. Others are not. This is that first year of the program. Now, I will not fault anyone for making the calculation that I think you're about ready to make, because there are no penalties for withdrawing at this point in time. And you know you've got to sign up for this year right there, and you've already done much of the work. And so I would never criticize anyone for saying, well, until a few more of these things are resolved, I want to go slow and defer on these things. The other thing to do is look at the USDA website for that conservation measurement tool, because that has that checklist in it that you've gone through now of how how your operation stacks up, and that's being used to determine those point scores and for being able to make a determination. And that's a key one for any of you that may be considering an application for CSP. I would expect with this next year, we're going to have that much crisper. The challenge that you've got right now is you're in the first sign-up. There were way more acres offered in this first year than there are dollars to do. Remember, it's 12 million acres that are going to be in, and there was way more acres offered. And so that's part of the quandary right now, is that until they know how many people withdraw, they don't know if they have to draw a line and say, tell some people they're not eligible, or if there'll be enough people that will withdraw to be able to do that. I think that's contributing to the uncertainty that you're facing. Other easy questions like that one. Yes, sir.
Tracy, briefly mentioned about the hospital in school.
Okay.
I'd like to know what you think the high prices are on campus. Is that just additional money, or is it going to be still moving to $4,000?
I'm sure you will be limited to the existing payment limits for the existing programs that you're participating in. I don't think they'll let you go over the top on that. It is, in theory, additional money for those states and for those particular watersheds over above what would normally be allocated. Each program has a complex allocation formula that's supposed to send money to a state based off of how much environmental need is in that particular state. And so those states in the Mississippi Basin that have watersheds will be receiving additional financial resources this year than they would have normally received as a result of that program. There will also be, and I didn't mention this program but in the summary, but there's something called the Conservation Innovation Grants and the Cooperative Conservation Programs that are used to incentivize either new innovative conservation practices that need a little more research, or in the case of cooperative conservation, community-wide partnerships. And you'll see both of those very active in the Mississippi Basin initiatives that will be out there. I'm also aware of at least one major foundation that is trying to figure out how to tap on top of those things. And that is the Walton Family Foundation. They're looking for how they can provide additional resources on top of that initiative. And so there are the three more opportunities that may be out there for you that are in one of those watersheds. Which watershed are you in, sir? Little River. Which states? Missouri. Okay. Other questions?
Bruce, you said that the payment limit is the interpretation of when off the air.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? It scares me to think that they may influence the FSA office and change their interpretation and really mess up that. Such as Jimmy and myself, in a general partnership. I know what I'm doing now, but did that ever happen? Yeah, I know. Why in the world don't we live off the same interpretation?
It's, one, you've got certain differences between the agencies, fair amount of rivalry between NRCS and FSA, which tends to complicate that greatly, and you have at present a great deal of emphasis on small farm initiatives. And so all of this is creating a perfect storm that is rather imperfect for us, and one that, that I think makes all of us nervous as it pertains to payment limits. The point to make on these things is the point that Jay was making, and that is that conservation should not be tied to the same sort of payment limits that's done with income transfer and with farm programs. Because philosophically, it shouldn't matter about the size of the farm operation if the government is purchasing a particular set of environmental goods and services. If you're wanting your, if USDA or any federal agency wants to restore a wetland, it shouldn't matter whether Bruce Knight owns that wetland or a movie star owns that wetland. If there is a desire to make an investment on improving water quality or water quantity, it shouldn't matter whether that farm operation is 50 acres or 5,000 acres. As a matter of fact, to really make a difference in a particular watershed, the only way you can do it is by having large commercial size operations contributing and being a vital part of this. And this is what distresses me about the current direction that's very apparent at present.
The same program office of forestry, which we have over 8,000 acres of part of the Valley Timber, Department of Water Reform, the Wildlife Habitat, the Wildlife Biologists, all the things that we did, just to do the right things in terms of that. That person is the highest because of all the things we did with the habitat, the injuries, and so forth. Only we didn't know it because the amount of money was too small relative to those sources. So why would you encumber 8,000 acres and 800 acres this time?
Mm-hmm.
So is there a problem with the same thing?
Yes, sir.
Of course.
Yeah.
And that's where the very small competition is probably complicated.
Now, as we're talking about this, and many of us are in agreement on the concerns here with some of the size limits, I want to get back to what I was talking about on improving the odds. Remember, we've been talking a lot about the payment limit frustrations that many of the folks here in this room are having with CSP. Understand, that is a separate and distinct payment limit than EQIP. EQIP and CSP are different programs and different payment limits than the Conservation Reserve Program and the WRP. And the Conservation Reserve Program lands and the WRP lands are not eligible for participation in CSP. So as you're looking at these things and you're bumping up against some of these efforts, what you may end up doing is, if it works for you to utilize CRP and WRP, is park some acres in those programs, only if that's appropriate for you, but park some of those acres in those programs rather than doing that. And for those of you that have grasslands or rangelands associated with your operation, you can use the Grasslands Reserve Program in the same way. But remember, with each of those, you're talking about either a long-term rental range or a long-term easement, and that's really got to fit well with your particular philosophy for your farming operation. Other questions or observations? Yes, sir.
Are there still benefits for, I set my son up in a farm a few years ago, and he was a new farmer with benefit, and today, well, I think it's readily accepted.
There are, for all of the conservation programs, there are specific rules for beginning farmer and limited resource producers. And with those provisions actually allow things like the cost share to go higher. Generally, that cost share can go about 15% higher than what may be prevalent. So in EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, if the cost share is at 50%, the limited resource one would be at 65%, or if it's all the way up to 75% on a particular practice, it would go to 90% on that. So that's there. There's a special allocation for beginning farmers and limited resource producers in the new CSP program as well. So that flexibility is very much there.
Okay, I got another one.
Okay, Jimmy. I get nervous with these coming from the podium.
Well, in Jimmy's situation, when he put everything in and found out he was over the limit.
Yes.
Okay. I figure out, and I only put enough in my operation to know what would be covered. I've got some other land. Can they find out? If they don't talk to the FSA office, how can they find out?
This program. Remember, I told you that there were some things that were found out that are causing the changes in the program now. That's as a result of the audit. I would expect there to continue to be audits, so I would expect those things to be discovered. I do think that control of land does provide, in some cases, some flexibility on those sorts of things. The other thing is, I know exactly what you're thinking about is if I look at the CMT, and I should be offering only as much as I think I'll get paid for under the payment limits, that's probably a good strategy, but the flip side of that is you will also be lowering your ranking for your farm operation compared to all the others. But that may be a prudent risk because this will be offered on an annual basis. Every year, another 12.7 million acres will go in, and so you might be well served by waiting for some of those first round of contracts to get accepted before you put yours in. I'm going to turn the podium back over to you.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you all for coming this afternoon. I do want to encourage all of you. The NRCS office in my county, I have a great relationship with the woman that works in there, and she does a super job for us. In fact, she knows how my brother and I operate, and she will call us and say, I've got a program here that's come in that I think will work for y'all. I think that's the benefit of what Bruce was saying, develop a relationship. We've all developed a relationship in the FSA office because we know we've got to go in there and get everything straight because we're going to get some money out of it. Now, like Jay said, this isn't an enhancement for sure, what we're trying to do, but you're trying to make your farm better, and if you can get some help, that would encourage us to do these operations that will make our farm better. Any other comments? Well, with that, I'll say we're adjourned. Thank you for coming.